Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the minutes for February 23rd are approved. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. What we're going to do, members, I know there's a lot happening here at the legislature. We are first going to hear from Megan Gooner, if she would like to come up to the table. She will go till about 5 o'clock. Then we will have, she's from the University of Minnesota. Then we will have Dr. Robert Anda, who's a senior scientific consultant with the Centers for Disease Control. We decided to put him second because we think that the brain research first will be the best way to go. And then we will also hear from Dr. Richard Chase, who will talk about the well-being and vulnerabilities of children aged 3 and younger in Minnesota. So it's really all the things that we legislate for about what's happening to kids. This is the scientific research backing that up. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Is it permitted to stand? My mouth is attached to my feet.
Well, there's the issue is we're taping.
Oh, you're
and
right.
So
stay down here.
So you'll need to say your name for the record, and yeah, we prefer you
happy
stay
to
there.
My name is Megan Gunner. I'm a Regents Professor at the University of Minnesota. And what I'm bringing you today is not just my own research. It's part of the work that we've been doing on the National Scientific Council for the Developing Child. Some of you know that a number of years ago, the National Institute of Medicine convened a panel to review the science of early child development and provide guidance to policymakers about what we actually did know about early experience and brain development. And that panel, of which I was a part, produced the volume called Neurons to Neighborhoods, which I hope some of you have had a chance to read. The National Scientific Council followed on from that work. We've been meeting ever since, convening groups of neuroscientists and developmental scientists to continue to go through the research, to sift it, and to make sure that what we were saying to the public was grounded in solid research basis. So what I'm bringing you today is the information that we feel that we could credibly stand up in front of almost all scientists. You'll always find one, right? But almost all scientists, and they would agree that what I'm telling you is as much as we actually do know about early experience. Obviously, we're interested in this because the foundation of prosperity and sustainability, science now clearly does show, begins in early childhood. The healthy development of young children provides a strong foundation for healthy and competent adulthood in terms of responsible citizenship, economic productivity, and critically, the capacity to competently parent the next generation. By extension, ensuring healthy development of children supports communities and a just and fair society. But how do we get there? What is neuroscience and developmental science telling us about how we get there? How do we build a healthy brain architecture? What are the ingredients? We know, of course, that genes are important, the genes you inherit. But ultimately, our brain and our genes are shaped by the experiences that we have early in life, both positive experiences and negative experiences. And while the genes you inherit provide the hardware telling the brain where to put certain kinds of neurons, the wiring up of that hardware is determined through experience. It's basically the brain wires itself through the activity that it engages in, and that activity is incorporating information and action on the environment. So brains organize themselves through experience, wiring their diagram based on the kind of activity that the brain engages in during its development. There are going to be four numbers I hope that you remember from this presentation. 700 a second, 18 months, I'll tell you why you're going to remember these in a minute, 90 to 100%, and 3-to-1 odds. If you can see it, this is a picture of little neurons at birth. And if you can see this little diagram, you'll see that they actually aren't touching each other. For neurons to communicate information, they have to make connections with other neurons. And at birth, in this part of the brain, the genes have said, hey, we want pyramidal cells. That's actually what you're looking at. And they are there, but they haven't wired up. By 6 years of age, we have an incredible set of connections here. And that's because 700 connections are made a second during the early periods of brain development. Now, this is actually not a terribly efficient brain. Everything is connected to everything else. What will happen over time is those pathways where information is being passed and responses are coming back saying, hey, you did something, they'll be confirmed. And the other connections will fall away. So that by the time we get to 14 years of age, now we have fewer connections, but these pathways are efficient. Okay? Now, the brain wires itself, in essence, from the bottom up. This process of overproducing connections and then pruning back begins in the back part of the brain with the areas of the brain that are involved in vision and hearing. And that time scale, the peak is there about 3 months of age, and the pruning is pretty well completed by 3 years of age. Language, the pathways that are involved in language have a slightly later period, reaching peak at about 7 to 9 months of age and pruning over those next few years. Whereas the parts of the brain, what I had actually showed you at the beginning, those were in frontal regions that deal with higher order cognition. Those are getting wired up later in development. The challenge is that the wiring of later parts of the brain depends on the adequate wiring of earlier parts of the brain, because these are not just separate entities. And how well you wire up your brain for higher cognitive functions depends on good wiring and good information then coming from these regions that were being developed largely during the first few years of life. How do we get our brain wired? Well, the core component of that is something we call serve and return. I told you that neurons are active, and they're processing information, and what gets retained are pathways that make sense, that are processing good information. Healthy development of brain architecture depends on serve and return, an interaction, like a game of tennis. The brain forms an idea, it performs an action, a response comes back, the neurons say, yippee skippy, we did what we were supposed to, confirm that pathway. It requires that kind of serve and return experience. Young children instinctively reach out for interaction. They babble, they coo, they make facial expressions. And in a good serve and return environment, when they do that, something reacts and they get positive feedback, and the brain is wiring itself incredibly actively through that kind of serve and return experience. And of course that works well, better, with people that the baby knows and that knows the baby. Because if you can imagine playing tennis with a 3-year old, they're serving that ball all over the court. But as an adult who knows that child, you anticipate that and you make corrections, and the child experiences competency. So it works better with familiar people who know how to serve and return well with that child. So skills and the brain are shaped by the serve and return aspects of human interaction during early development, beginning with the eye gaze, and then the interactions maybe of a grandparent with their child, working around in the reading environment so that you're not just reading a book at a child. It's an active process of communicating over the book. The child is developing language skills to be able to learn how to read. It's very important that they actually play with children of their own age also, because they're not as good serve and return partners. And it's as they try to work with somebody who is equally incompetent that they learn to adjust themselves to understand how to compensate for others, which they don't often get working with adults who compensate for their needs. And ultimately, we have a child who is able to enter school with a well-formed brain architecture and language skills and competencies. So 18 months. Unfortunately, we see the barriers to early competency in school emerging early. This, many of you know, this Hart and Risley study, they looked at children who were the offspring of welfare parents, working class parents, and college educated parents. They were counting the number of words in the child's vocabulary. By 16 months, of course, there aren't many words in a kid's vocabulary, nothing differed. But by 24 months of age, you could begin to see that the language environment of the child, and this is what they were really tracking, was really, and by 36 months, there's what you're trying to overcome. Once kids are at school, to get rid of the social class differences, they're already there by 3 months, or 3 years of age. We also know that the experiences in childhood have lasting impacts on how our fear and stress systems are organized. good experiences tend to bias these systems so that children see the glass as half empty or full rather than half empty. They're curious about new things. They're willing to approach and explore. They recognize danger, but they don't over-recognize danger. We know that early childhood adversity can influence a lifelong range of outcomes. We believe that much of this is happening through the very same mechanisms that are going to bias this fear and stress system and increase our risk for a variety of disorders. So children who grow up in threatening contexts, they get extremely good at identifying threat. They need to get good at identifying threat. They see the glass as half empty. They see the threats that are there, even if the threats aren't there. And the challenge that this creates for us is that it's going to, in a sense, capture their brains and make it very difficult for them to be curious and to not go into a threat defense mode. We know from some of my own work that if we measure stress hormone levels, and it's the hormones that are playing a role in shaping the threat biology of the brain, that if we look at children who are growing up, I call these actually Garrison Keillor kids when I'm in Minnesota because that's what they are. They're in middle to upper middle class, low risk families. Their levels are generally low. They have pretty organized. This is actually measuring dysregulation of the rhythms. But if we look at children who are neglected and maltreated and are going into foster care or who are living in orphanages, about 30 to 35% of those children, no matter what kind of sample we look at, have very dysregulated stress systems, the types that should be indexing sort of a chronic working on these fear systems of the brain to heighten their capacity to detect threat and reduce the capacity to be able to explore the environment in a curious and open way. We know a lot now in neuroscience about the architecture of fear and anxiety. There are three regions here. I don't know if you can see it on what you've got up there, and I can't really point to it. But you see that little pink thing in the circle down below? That is called the amygdala. It's a very critically important structure for detecting threat. The green looks like a little bit of a green bean. Is your hippocampus. That's a critically important structure for remembering things long term. And then we've circled here the frontal part of the brain, which is your higher order reasoning area. These three regions are critically important in orchestrating fear and anxiety. And they are also the same regions that we need to use for learning and memory. And what happens when you are anxious and your brain shuts down and you can't think and reason and you just want to run is your fear system has grabbed a hold of your higher reasoning system and it's co-opted it for defense. So you can't do one without the other. We can't train learning, reading, and memory things in kids without also dealing with the need to help them feel safe in the process, or else their brain's going to be hijacked by the fear system. Okay, stress is not all bad. There is certainly positive stress. Brief periods of slight elevations in threat, helping the child sort of tone that system, learn that in safe contexts I can calm down. Actually, great stuff. Don't protect your kids from all stress. We also know that there's tolerable stress, things we would prefer not to have children experience, death of a loved one, be in a car accident, where the stress system kicks in. But we know that in the context of support of others, that child will be able to manage that experience without long-lasting negative outcomes. In fact, PTSD in young children occurs more often if they're in a car accident, if their parents badly hurt, than if they're badly hurt, because you knock out the safety figure, that's really threatening. It's more threatening than just breaking your leg or having, does that make sense? So tolerable stress, you got to have the regulatory system, the relationship system there. What we worry about is this thing we're calling toxic stress. This is the frequent activation of these fear and stress systems in the absence of support of others, so the child is not able to turn off the threat. We know that it operates at multiple levels. This is a work that actually, if you can see this happening, this is a cool little morphing program where you take a picture of someone exhibiting a fear face over here and the same person, a happy face, and you just switch pixels. Just a few little, and as you move in towards the center, you're like about at the middle, you're at 50% fear and 50% happy is actually in that face. If I show you these faces, at some point, like the color spectrum, you'll see a shift in the emotion, and you'll say, oh, okay, now he's fearful. Oh, okay, now he's happy. And if we do this with happy to fearful and happy to sad, and you're a typically developing kid, it's roughly about in the middle where you see the switch, okay? If you have been physically abused severely, exactly the same spot for happy to sad or happy to fearful. But anytime we toss in an angry face, anytime an angry face is there, angry to fearful, angry to sad, typically developing kids, it's about the same place. And that's what happens to kids who have been severely physically abused. They need very few cues, very few cues, that might be an angry face before they say it's anger. Which means that they're seeing anger, even in ambiguous faces. They're exquisitely tuned to perceive threat in the environment. Okay? That's going to potential, and they do this when we measure brain electrical activity before consciousness. The brain is already showing before it gets to conscious levels that they're processing, they're sending signals to the threat center saying, danger. And it's going to rob them of the capacity often to use the higher order reasoning to explore and learn. 90 to 100%, I'm doing almost okay here.
Okay, probably about 5 minutes.
I know. I'm going to get to my 3-to-1 odds and then I'll be done. 90 to 100%, this comes from work on studying children who have experienced various types of toxic stress. And we can all list a variety of things that should create toxic stress in young kids. If you study a large group of kids and just count the number of things they've been exposed to, just add up the risks, and you give them developmental tests to see who's been developmentally delayed, who's falling behind on all these elements of developmental growth that are necessary for performing well in school, we find that it's related to the number of risk factors. By the time you're at 6 and 7, 90 to 100% of those kids are developmentally delayed. 3-to-1 odds, Robert Anda is going to give you this chapter and verse about adverse childhood experiences and what they are associated with in terms of adult health. All I'm going to mention here is, sorry, Robert, it's your punchline, is that in addition to things like drug and alcohol abuse and depression and so on that might not surprise you, what we are seeing also is that these early childhood adversities, again, adding up the number, are related to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease in adulthood. We were standing outside saying, we don't just need the early childhood, we need those health and human services guys in here, because what's happening early is affecting their part of the budget as well. We now understand a lot more about the mechanisms that are producing this. Some of you are old enough that when you go to your doctors now, they're measuring C-reactive protein, CRP levels, to see if you're at risk of a heart attack. This is an inflammatory process that we can detect in the blood that increases risk of cardiovascular disease. In this next study, the kids are 25 years old, way before we'd ever see cardiovascular disease. And if we look at typically developing low-risk kids, maybe 20% have an increased level in their blood. But if they've been maltreated as children, they're 25 now. If they're maltreated and have developed depression, by the way, depression and heart disease are linked, we believe through these kinds of mechanisms of shifting the production of inflammatory cytokines. Inflammatory, CRP is an inflammatory cytokine. Nature has a logic. Those inflammatory cytokines are what you do as your first defense against pathogens. They're shifting the body as well as the brain to react as if the world is full of danger. And it's maybe keeping you alive, but it's going to kill you early. So toxic stress also, 2 more minutes. We know changes brain architecture. What you've got on the top is a normal, beautiful nerve cell. And you can see all its lovely connections. Expose that nerve cell to chronic levels of elevated stress hormone, and you see what happens at the bottom. And that's what you should be focusing on. And if we look on each of these little spines, or dendrites, then you see that these little dots, those are the connections where it would make connections with other nerve cells, and toxic stress cuts down the possibility for making nerve connections. In adults, if you have experience of really chronic stress, you're dealing with your dying parent, it's really, really been stressful, this will happen to your brain. But after it's over, your brain will come back because it knows where it's supposed to go back to. In kids, it may not go back because the brain has been developing and making these connections, and we're sort of past the point of being able to come back. Does that make sense? So this is the point of what I'm telling you. Toxic stress, environmental exposures to adversity, malnutrition gets biologically embedded into the brain and the body during sensitive periods of early development. There's a cumulative burden of this over time, disrupting the brain, the immune system, metabolic, the whole body is being affected. And as we move out to adulthood, we're seeing increased risk of disease and disorder, health-threatening events, and low educational achievement, which will help carry all of this forward. It's possible to intervene. Our evidence suggests that the earlier you get in, the better off the child will be. And we have interventions. We know how to do this. It's not a matter of not knowing. It's a matter of political and economic will to shift the odds for the youngest children. So we've got a healthy brain architecture at the time that we're sending these kids off and wanting to educate them in school. And any elementary preschool teacher will tell you, give me a child who's ready to learn, where I don't have to go back and repair the brain and repair the behaviors. I can teach that child. They can come to school without their ABCs. As long as they're ready and capable of learning, I can teach that. What's really tough is to go back and try to repair that brain that's already been set off track. So that's what I have to tell you.
Well, thank you. I think it's fascinating for us, and I know that your research is well known. I think what we'll do is have Dr. Anda, and then if there's questions, members, we also want to make sure we have enough time for Dr. Richard Chase.
Sure.
One thing, members, I want you to think about is what would be interesting here at the legislature if we could have certain members be more experts. I know current Dr. Lane, almost Dr. Lane, Representative Lane, Representative Bly. I know some of you are more interested in this. If there's folks on the bipartisan basis are interested in the research. It's interesting work and things that we need to pay attention to. So what we'll have Dr. Anda go, and can you stay? Or
I told my husband he was on his own.
Okay, well, then you can stay. This committee meets at a terrible time. Speaking of which, we have a couple members that have other commitments tonight. But there's everything from kid activities that happen right now to all kinds of things, as we all know. So we apologize if we have members coming in and out, too. That's something that happens. I want to point out, Jane, do you want to raise your hand? Jane Kretzman from the Minnesota Foundation. And she has funded, you funded?
Oh.
So she put on an institute this past year. I know several of you were there. I don't know if it's going to become an annual thing or if you're going to do another one, but it...
2011,
if members are interested in that, it helps to understand the architecture of the brain. And we appreciate you bringing in Dr. Anda. He's been to several places in the last 2 days. Last night there was a dinner with legislators. I know that several of you were there, Representative Peterson and Representative Lane, Representative Bry. And I know he met with several DHS people today, and his work is very interesting because it shows us what's happening at the CDC and sort of correlations to diseases along with some of the stress that goes on in early childhood. So we'll see if we can get our technical stuff working here. And all right, there we go. Welcome to the committee.
I'm ready.
You need to state your name for the record. And
I'm Rob Anda. And I live in Atlanta currently, and I am a physician and epidemiologic researcher and consultant to the CDC in Atlanta.
And proceed with your testimony.
It's been a great trip here. I'm tired. I see a lot of tired faces, but I'm gonna start by using this quote, which says that early experiences help to determine brain structure, thus shaping the way we learn, think, and behave for the rest of our lives, which is what Megan just told us about. And I miss my family. I've been away for a few days. This is my daughter. My daughter, Kelsey, when she was a baby. She's 18 now. and she's still just as beautiful, if not more, than she was at that age. And in keeping with the, I know that there's a place for fishing. How many lakes here? Many lakes, anyway. I live in Atlanta, and I'm going to tell you this story because it's a story of hope, of stress, hopefully not too toxic, fish story. I live south of the airport in Atlanta in a wooded community with a beautiful little lake, and it's a great fishing lake. And I'm not a very good fisherman. I fish at night out of my canoe, and one night I hooked this fish, and I challenge any Minnesota fisherman to catch a largemouth bass that big in Minnesota. Anyway, it was so big, I was so excited that I called my wife. I had my cell phone. I didn't have a scale or anything. And I said, you've got to see this fish. And she came down and she brought my son, Will, who's the little boy here in the picture, and he's thrilled. And so I used Will as the scale to show just how big this fish was. And when I caught it, it was big enough that I could get half of my arm down inside of it. And so I thought, well, maybe a better scale for my golf buddies would be to turn to my son, which I did, and say, Will, turn your head sideways, and I am going to put your head inside the mouth of this largemouth bass. And he became terrified. A few years later, he told my wife that he wants to be a child psychiatrist. And I'm here to talk about toxic stress and its effect on life choices and behavior and decisions. So take that for what it's worth. Megan talked about toxic stress, and I just want to briefly go through this little piece of art that shows a little boy at a family dinner table. He is undergoing toxic stress. This is violence. This scenario damages his brain because his stress response is activated, and the chemicals of stress that we can't control, and especially children cannot control, are toxic to the developing nervous system. So this little boy is, through the behavior and experience of his parents or whoever it might be around him, is having his neural networks damaged, and they will not develop in ways that we would like. This is what we call the adverse childhood experiences at the bottom of the pyramid. ACE is the acronym, ACE. The ACE pyramid, it's a whole life model on the left from conception to death. And I spent the first part of, most of the first part of my career working in the red part of the pyramid. I'm trained in internal medicine, adult medicine, and I studied risk behaviors. And I tried in primary care to modify risk factors for disease and disability. And I can assure you, it was really discouraging. I worked in emergency rooms. I worked in prisons. And I decided that I wanted to get into where do those risk factors come from? It's hard to modify them. So the idea of this study was if you can understand where they come from and prevent them from occurring in human populations, then you've really got a leg up on reducing disease, disability, and social problems and premature death, which are on the top of the life pyramid. So that's the idea of the study. And the second layer of the pyramid is that these experiences lead to social, emotional, and cognitive thinking impairments that are all built sequentially through healthy neurodevelopment. And when that's disrupted, what you will see is an extraordinary relationship to the risk factors for health and social problems in this country. So the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, is something that we conducted in the Kaiser Health Plan in San Diego County among 17,000 people. These are people who are educated people. They're middle class, upper middle class people, and they have probably the best health care in the country. So this is a socio-demographic group that is really pretty well off. And you know, keep that in mind when you see the burden of toxic stress that these people grew up with. On the surface, things look really good, but you scratch the surface and you find some pretty disturbing things. The first disturbing thing is that adverse childhood experiences are common even in this kind of population. These are the 10 experiences, 10 ACEs. 27% grew up with substance abusing people in their household, 23% with parents who couldn't get along and maintain their relationship, which is stressful for kids. 17% had mentally ill household members, raising them or giving them care. 13% witnessed their mothers being beaten. And 6% had criminal behavior in their house, as evidenced by having someone in their house imprisoned while they were growing up. 11% were psychologically abused, 28% physically, and more than 1 in 5, 21%, were sexually abused. 15% were emotionally neglected, and 10% were physically neglected. This is in middle-class, upper-middle-class America with health care and mostly with college educations. Megan talked about toxic stress and its effect on the thing that all of these adversities have in common is they evoke stress. Stress in high doses or repeated doses is a poison. You're probably familiar with lead and its effect on developing brains, lead poisoning. This is stress poisoning. Stress is poison when it's too much for kids. So after noting that these experiences were common, we also found in our look at this information from these 17,000 people is that the experiences come in groups in children's lives. They don't come one at a time. And in this slide, what we're looking at is three sets of bars. If you look at the left-hand one, is the height of that is a percentage of these people that were emotionally abused as children. The colors, that's the height of the bars. The colors from white to blue, from left to right, is increasing frequency of watching your mother being beaten while you're growing up. The white is never, and then it goes sometime or once or twice, sometimes, often, or very often. And if you look at the scale on the left-hand one, it goes from 5%. 5% of people who did not have battered mothers were emotionally abused. It's nearly 80% where their mothers were beaten very often. And you see this same pattern for the middle set, which is physical abuse, and the right-hand set, which is sexual abuse. Extraordinary risk for abuse, where mothers and women are treated violently. So the way we dealt with this, and a way I'd like you to think as we look more into this data, is that if you imagine that you were one of these 17,000 people and you had told us that you grew up seeing your mother being beaten, if you're one of those people, and I know there are some people in this room that did see that, I'm certain of that, if you had that, your chance of having an additional stressor, toxic stressor, an additional ACE is 95%. Where there's violence against women in the house, it's universal that there are other toxic stressors. And if you go to the far right-hand side, to five or more ACEs, half of the time, you would have had five more. So you have one, your mother is one stressor, witnessing your mother being beaten, you got five more, that gives you six. And if you think of this like lead poisoning, this is toxic to the brain. It adds up. It accumulates. It's a dose. It's a higher dose. So what we did is we created an adverse childhood experiences score out of those 10 categories of stressors. And we just added them up. They all counted for 1 point. And what you see here is that for a score of 0, only 1 in 3 people in the Kaiser Health Plan had none of those in their background in their childhood. Only 1 in 3. If you go to 4 or more, it's 16%. So 1 or 2 out of every 10 people receiving services in the Kaiser Health Plan, or for that matter in San Diego County anywhere, are carrying with the cumulative toxic burden of 4 or more adverse childhood experiences and its effect on their learning and behavior and thinking. Let's look at health issues. ACEs and obesity. Across the bottom is the ACE score increasing from 0 to 1, 2, 3, and 4 or more. And the height of these bars is the percentage of people with severe obesity, morbid obesity. It triples. The risk of severe obesity triples as the ACE score goes from 0 to 4, and it's graded in between, which we call dose response. What is the dose? What is the dose, folks? The dose is how much stress response they were exposed to as children. Teen pregnancy. In the left-hand set is the A score. The colors are the A score going from 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 more. The height of the bars is first sexual intercourse by age 14. So kids who undergo more toxic stress are more likely to become sexually active earlier. The middle set is the percentage of women that ever had a teen pregnancy. That goes up with toxic stress. And the right-hand set is the percentage of guys who ever impregnated a teenage girl. More toxic stress, more teen pregnancy. Mental health. This is depression. Depression is the leading cause of morbidity in Minnesota and every state in the United States and every developed country. It's the leading cause of disability. On this slide, across the bottom, the ACE scores increase. Increasing stress dose across the bottom. And if you look at the pink bars, which represent women, those with an ACE score of 0 have a 15% chance of having depression during their lives, and it goes up progressively to 60% for an ACE score of 4 or more. 60%. We estimate that half of depression has its origins in adverse childhood experiences and the toxic effects on the development of the emotional brain, the middle part of the brain. This is attempted suicide. Attempted suicide goes from 1% to 20% across the ACE score 0 to 4 more. A 20-fold increase in the risk of suicide. What about other leading health and social problems? Here we have drug abuse. The format is the same here. The colors, as the colors go from the left to the right, from the light green to the white, is increasing toxic dose, toxic stress dose. The risk of ever having a problem with street drugs increases 6 times. The risk of addiction to street drugs increases 7 times. And the risk of ever shooting up drugs, taking a needle and syringe and injecting drugs into a vein, goes up 40 times. It's almost zero. It's almost zero for people with an ACE score of 0. Almost nobody will do that. So in the absence of childhood toxic stress, it's hard to find people that shoot up drugs. You just don't do it. The AIDS epidemic is being perpetuated by the long-term consequences of toxic stress. Here we have, again, injected drug use, which transmits the HIV virus on contaminated needles. In the middle set is sexual promiscuity, having 50 or more sexual intercourse partners in a lifetime. And on the far right is ever having been diagnosed with a sexually transmitted disease, which is, of course, HIV is a sexually transmitted disease. So this is the ACE pyramid, the life path consequences of toxic stress on brain development and behavior, leading to behaviors that cause diseases that perpetuate the epidemic of AIDS, that cause heart disease, and many others. What about smoking? The left-hand set of bars shows becoming a regular cigarette smoker by age 12. Regular smoking by age 12. The middle set is being a current smoker as an adult, and the right-hand set is having chronic bronchitis or emphysema, which is diagnosed in the 6th, 7th, and 8th decades of life. Again, toxic stress messes with the brain, leads to behaviors, and this cascading effect throughout the lifespan of smoking, drug use, and the diseases that are consequent to those behaviors. And those behaviors are not because those people are stupid. Those behaviors are because those people are leading painful, confused lives, and they find in their environment things that make them feel better, like nicotine and heroin and street drugs. And that's why the people who undergo toxic stress during their childhoods are more likely to keep doing these things. It's not that they don't understand that it has negative social and health consequences. They do it because it's the only way that they can find a sense of equilibrium in their lives, or to get away from their depression or anxiety or the confusion of not being able to fit in or succeed at school or maintain relationships. Megan showed this before. Again, this is a leading, coronary heart disease is a leading cause of death in the United States for women. The risk of coronary heart disease in women goes up 300% for those that have an ACE score of 7 or 8. They're 300% more likely to get coronary heart disease compared to those with an ACE score of 0. I know these are difficult times for budgets. I've heard this. I've seen legislators here. I see the drain. Direct health care costs. What are some of the direct health care costs of adverse childhood experiences, of impaired childhood development? Prescription drugs are one of them. Prescription drugs account for 44% of health care inflation. It's the most rapidly inflating health care costs. One of the long-term consequences of toxic stress is depression. And here in this bar graph, we see the amount of prescription antidepressants that people in the Kaiser Health Plan receive as relates back to their childhoods. So for an ACE score of 0, it's the count is 30. The weight is 30. For an ACE score of 5 or more, it's 100. And it steps up. Dose response. Toxic dose, more depression, more prescriptions, and it's expensive. These are very expensive medications. And it lasts all the way through late adulthood. When we look at the Medicare population here, you see this same pattern. Half of the prescriptions for antidepressants are because of the toxic stress that these people underwent during their childhoods decades earlier. I'm going to summarize here with a list. I believe that adverse childhood experiences are the premier, most important ever national health issue. More important than the development of antibiotics, more important than clean water and sanitation, because they permeate people's lives. They lead to problems with adolescent health, reproductive health, smoking, alcohol, drugs, sexuality, mental health, risk of re-victimization, including domestic violence and rape, stability of relationships and homelessness, and the ability of workers to do their jobs. They increase the risk of early death. People with high ACE scores are twice as likely to die by age 65 than those with low ACE scores. It leads to heart disease, lung disease, liver disease, lung cancer, suicide and injuries, HIV and STDs and others that we don't have time to talk about today. The strength of these findings indicate that adverse childhood experiences, toxic stress, are the leading determinant of health and social well-being throughout the lifespan. And I would be willing to have a respectful debate with anybody that's data-based to show me something that's anything like this in terms of its magnitude. Now, a little bit of relief from the bar graphs here. This is from the labors of Hercules. Hercules was asked to do 12 things. One of them was to slay a mythical beast called the Hydra, this lizard-like creature, dragon-like creature here with many heads. And so he set about to do that and went out into the woods and found it. And being the great hero that he was, he said, "This is going to be easy. I've got a club or a sword." And he went up to one of the heads. He got one. You see it drop to the forest floor there? He got one. And to his surprise, when he got one, two grew back on the neck. He's trying to slay this thing one head at a time. And when he did that all by himself, he doubled his trouble. And fortunately, Athena, the goddess of the hunt, sent a mortal along to see what was going on. And this mortal, and I've forgotten his name, was carrying a torch, a firebrand. And he discovered that if Hercules cut off a head and cauterized the neck, job done. There's one head gone. But the beast had hundreds or thousands of heads. So it took a while. But the point here is that I want you to walk away with is that this is the first mythologically documented incident of interagency collaboration and bipartisan work on a major health issue. Okay? Now, I want you to step back a minute. What I've just told you, I think art works, the metaphors work, to stick with people. This is a person, this dragon represents a person exposed to toxic stress. The body is the embodiment of toxic stress as manifested by brain dysfunction and the behaviors and diseases and social problems that lead to it. Those are the heads. And the heads literally measure in the thousands. Anything that can be disrupted in human functioning gets disrupted by this. So there's thousands of heads. And if you would, if you held up a mirror, if you had a mirror in your pocket and you held it up to that creature, and you looked at it, or I point it back out to you, what you're looking at is you. You're looking at your service systems. You're looking at all of the various ways that our society has understandably undertaken to look at these problems one at a time. The challenge is to get all of these different systems, the mental health system, the K-12, the pre-K system, HIV prevention, domestic violence prevention, you name it, to understand that their problem comes out of the same body. It comes out of the same body, out of the same set of experiences that mess with childhood development. And you haven't stopped me. Should I keep talking?
Well, Dr. Anda, I know we have a couple members have to leave. I want to see if any questions, Representative Kulik Jackson, Representative Rosenthal, any reactions?
Wow. I do have a question, and that is, as if this wasn't enough, one of the big issues in Minnesota right now is sexual predators, and the ones who continue to be dangerous, and what do we do? And it's so expensive, this sort of treatment/incarceration forever, that I keep wondering, why we don't front end some money into prevention. And there's got to also be some kind of a tie in childhood experiences and criminal behaviors. And can you verify that?
Absolutely, yes. If you want to prevent sexual predation and you want to prevent sexual victimization, you prevent adverse childhood experiences. And if you want to prevent criminal behaviors, if you want to prevent violence, domestic violence, if you want to have fewer children in juvenile justice, we have data from Washington on that, you prevent adverse childhood experiences. If you want kids to get better grades in school and go to college, you prevent adverse childhood experiences. And that's why I think the Hydra is useful, because no matter what you're interested in, if it is an important human function that you want to deal with, you will find that it has its origins in childhood development and how it gets messed up by all these common bad things that happen to kids.
Very powerful. Representative Lane?
Well, I am chomping at the bit around. Another thing that I see it preventing is, and if you refer back to early 1900s and child rearing in Germany, which was very strict and no touching and not nurturing and not responsive to the needs, and it has been, I believe, shown how it led to the vulnerabilities to a particular approach to handling your society. And I wonder now, this sense of children having the threat, even when we wouldn't necessarily see it as a threat, but they see a threat, and the sense of victimization and fear and defensiveness, which is needed in their life but isn't actually appropriate for society that we live in, and you end up with buying into conspiracy theories and no trust and we need strong military defense and just really a very, very difficult way to handle a democracy.
Dr. Ando?
I'm going to be careful with that one. Well, let me just say this, that we've worked for multiple years with people at the Department of Defense to look at adverse childhood experiences in active duty personnel, and they're really high. And it's related to the same problems that you saw here in this Kaiser cohort. It's related to their mental health problems after serving on duty, especially in combat. I'm not here to promote combat or to promote any particular issue, but these issues are everywhere in our society, in all aspects of society, and the violence, you know, the gang violence. I've been to group homes, you know, where there are children that grew up in drug houses with gang violence. One little boy cut off the head of another child. He's 12 years old, and he's in a group home. And you talk to that boy, and he said, "You have no." He's behaving reasonably well now. I said, "But you have no idea what life is like for me, and I do not." And he's trying to do it. He's a great little kid. He's learning to play the guitar. So you know, you talk about violence. If you want me to speculate, I can speculate on some things, but I'm not sure that that's my role here.
Thank you. I think Representative Bly has a question, and then we're going to need to move on. I wanted to let the members know I do meet with the testifiers ahead of time, and we had talked, and the members can contact you. Your email is somewhere in your information?
If I didn't put it there, I can
okay?
Give it to you. You can write it down. I can give it to you now if you wish.
If you're okay with us emailing you?
It's my name, okay. Robanda. @bellsouth.net.
Okay.
And if I might have one more moment, so that something I forgot.
Sure. Can we do a quick question and then we'll have you close? Or do you want to go first? Okay, why don't you go and then we have one
comment.
Quick question. Okay.
If you look at this photograph, how many children are there of this age in the state of Minnesota? 400,000 maybe? Five, you know, in this age? 2 to 4? 300,000. That was a pretty good guess for me, I guess. Every year there are approximately 70,000 babies born in the state of Minnesota. And seeing what I've seen, I think of this nationally because I work for a federal agency, but thinking of Minnesotans, if you could at some point in time step back from all of the difficulties that you're facing and all of the silos that you're facing and sit back and say, there's 70,000 coming this year, and blue sky. What can we start to do differently that is inexpensive, and that can be done on a population scale for every child, wherever they are? What are those things? There are things that work, and one of those things I believe that works is education on a population scale. It's worked over and over for incredible health issues like cardiovascular disease. You know, it's worked for smoking. It's worked for, if we can get people to click their seatbelts, you know, if we can get people to change their diets, which is a complex behavior, we can get people to change the way they interact with children. And it can be done on scale. And I urge you to step back and think about those 70,000 kids, because business as usual is going to lead to problems as usual, and it's going to lead to siloed care that's not integrated using common principles. And we'll all be in the grave, and there'll be another committee here and another guy with glasses from Atlanta and a goatee, you know, saying the same thing.
That's a good challenge. Let's see. Representative Bly?
Yeah. I'll try to be brief. I really appreciate many of the things that you've said, and as we said, I spoke to you last night a little bit about my experience with alternative education, and although I think you've made a really good case for why, if we want to prevent huge costs and problems later in life. It's really good to focus on early childhood. But you also mentioned last night something that I think you called trauma-aware care. And I think that one of the things I learned, and I appreciate what you said, that young people who gravitate towards a behavior, whether it's smoking or drug use or whatever, is really something that they are trying to deal with the trauma that they've experienced, and it makes them feel. And I have to say that in working with kids who struggle with these kinds of behaviors, you solve one and you find there are others that they turn to reestablish that kind of balance in their lives. And I really appreciated that comment. I think it's very true. But what I learned also is that you don't have to only focus on early childhood. When we engage the teenagers in our alternative programs, we were able to make changes which hopefully will help them in their lives and with their children. And in a teen parents program, for instance, we were able to help them engage in a better way in the schools when they took their young children to that school. And I think it's a place to start anyway that can really have an impact on this problem.
Dr. Renda?
I believe that it's essential. What you just said reminds me that I believe that it's essential that if you consider taking these kind of things on, that you use both prevention, population-based, relatively inexpensive methods simultaneously with methods to treat people affected by this, because people affected by this are interacting with children, and to use targeted approaches where the highest risk is. Population-based and targeted approaches are complementary. They are not exclusive. And they have been used effectively for decades, as I've mentioned, for other issues like cardiovascular disease and cancer prevention and stroke prevention. It's both. They're not exclusive. They're complementary.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. I think, members, it's good for us and all the things we have going on, which is mostly a big budget deficit that's been difficult. It's important for us to remember the research. And this is the third time I've seen your presentation, and I take away something different every time. Although now I have the Hydra firmly planted in my mind as an image that we won't soon forget, and appreciate you being here and sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we'll have Richard Chase from the Wilder Foundation, and he will be wrapping up and talking about the well-being and vulnerabilities of children aged 3 and younger in Minnesota. So we'll get the technology going here. Well, Sarah reminds me we started late because of that health committee that never gets out of here on time. Representative Lane, you have to talk to Chair Thiessen. And
he really tried.
I heard it was interesting today. And so we'll give you a couple extra minutes, although we hear they're coming back at 6, so they may be all starting to filter into the room. So, Dr. Chase, we do this to you a few times where you get caught in this crossways. We want to be respectful. We appreciate you're here and are eager to hear what you have to say.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, members of the committee. I'm Richard Chase from Wilder Research, Wilder Foundation. So you know everything you need to know about the benefits of serve and return and about the hazards of toxic stress and the adverse effects. So how are the 300,000 little brains in Minnesota doing? And who's doing better than others? Well, the good news is that most of the young children, 3 and younger, are doing quite well. But there's a sizable proportion, and we really don't know for sure because the data aren't good enough to let us look at it across sectors and across types of data. But it looks like 15 to 20% are not doing well. And the most vulnerable populations in Minnesota are the ones that are the fastest growing populations in Minnesota. I'll also show you that there's some troubling trends in some of the indicators of well-being, that they were improving, and now they're eroding and moving in the wrong direction. And you'll see that this is the best data available in the state, but I hope you are as dissatisfied as I am with the gaps and the lags in the data, and that when the bill comes forward for an integrated data system, you'll support it. So I know I was going to be rushed again, so I'm going to show, these are the conclusions, and then I'll come back to them at the end, but this is what I want you to take away, that similar to what Rob said, that if we keep doing what we're doing now, it's likely to just get worse, because of the growing populations at risk in the types of populations they are. So we have to not just do more of the same, but it has to be something completely different. And also the information I want to focus on today is that I know you're focused on school readiness, and it's important in this state. And a lot of that emphasis is on quality care for 3- and 4-year-olds. But it's very important, that's important, but we have to start earlier, and we have to focus on those young babies as well as the 3- and 4-year-olds. Because, as you heard from Megan and from Rob, this delayed interventions and delaying of help for the ones who need it the most, it harms their development at the genetic level. It becomes biologic. You can address it later, but it's better to prevent it to begin with. So the babies in Minnesota, it's the most diverse part of Minnesota population and growing more so. In this state, we got 14 to 15% persons of color. But when you talk about the babies, they're 23% of color. We have more like 74,000 births a year in the state, not 70,000. But why is it that way for young kids? It's because there's been more and more babies in African American populations, Asian populations, Latino populations, and in American Indian populations over the past 10 years than there were in proportion than in the white population. Half of those kids in the African American and Latino and Asian population are children of immigrants. This is, I think, an important fact to keep in mind where Minnesota stands. One of every 7 or 8 children of immigrants are in Minnesota, in this country. So Minnesota has a unique sort of experience of how do you engage the children of immigrants so they become productive citizens. And they start at a disadvantage early on, even starting at birth. So what can we do to improve their opportunities, prevent those achievement gaps before they even start? Because they will likely face more of these in the future if we just keep doing the same thing now. So who's taking care of these babies? Most of them are at home with their parents or with their grandparents. These are the people that are the best, probably, servers for the returners. You know, they know the child the best. They're best equipped to do that. But we know that many of them need support, and the state is, and you have supported that for family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. You're a national leader in support for family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. That's important to keep supporting that. It's also important when you think about quality of care that all kids need, all babies need skilled and nurturing providers, whether it's their parent or their caregiver. So 75,000 of them are in licensed care, and you're working on promoting a quality rating system to ensure that care is high quality, because that's not the norm now across the country, that it's not the norm that child care is always high quality. But as you promote and develop that quality rating system, think about how you can also integrate family, friend, and neighbor care into that on its own terms, so you don't destroy it. You can't formalize the informal, but you can help all babies by focusing not just on the 75,000 in licensed care, but the higher proportion that are in informal care, that where those caregivers also need to improve their quality of care. Depression, talked about as a key cause of morbidity in this country. Who's taking care of the babies? Oftentimes, it's a depressed parent, a depressed mother. There's all sorts of kinds of depression. It could be postpartum depression, which affects about 12% of Minnesota mothers, higher for low-income parents. But it's not just something that's treatable by taking a pill or by a prescription. I think what we have to do is to get at the root causes of this depression. And many of it is rooted in isolation, in disadvantage, and in economic insecurity. It's not just a mental health issue. It's also an economic issue. And that social interaction that the children need for secure social attachment is harmed and delayed if their caregiver is unable to be responsive. And so something has to be done for the children by also focusing on their parents. They need not just mental health services, but income supports, social support, not necessarily just some sort of prescription that you might get at a drugstore. Almost two-thirds of the children of our age three and younger have their primary caregivers in the workforce. So that's why they need to have child care either by their grandparent or by licensed care. This hasn't really changed that much since over the past 10 years. Minnesota has a very high number of mothers in the workforce. What has changed is poverty. We have that really 3 in 10 children in Minnesota that are age 3 and younger are growing up in an economically stressed environment. They are at 200% of poverty or below. You see poverty has increased from 12% in 2000 to 14% in 2009. I'm sure it's higher now than it was last time it was checked. It's just these families are severely affected by the recession, and that's affecting the types of stress that these parents are under. So it's affecting a large number of children. But it's disproportionate in the communities of color. Whereas 10% of the kids, white kids are in poverty, is almost half for American Indian children in this state, 43% for African American children. You can see it's disproportionate, and it's affecting the communities of color much more than white kids. But because of the number, you can see most of the poor kids are still white, but it's disproportionate in the communities of color. What about access to resources? Well, some of the good news, I'm not sure the health committee might have changed it this right before this, but 96% to 97% of these young kids are covered by health insurance, or they were the last time it was measured in 2007. So that's the good part. And 24% of that group is covered by a public option. So without the public programs for health for young kids in the state, there'd be a larger group of kids that are not insured. But that's a good news for this population, that they are covered by health insurance. Prenatal care also tends to be above national averages, but it's disproportionate by group. So if you are a child in a pregnant African-American woman, Asian woman, Hispanic woman, American Indian woman, you can see that they begin life at a disadvantage. Their prenatal care is not as adequate as for white children. So if we think of school readiness as a developmental process that begins prenatally, these kids are already starting at a disadvantage because of that prenatal care. We already have the gaps from the start. Here's some other good news. There's been success with getting newborns screened for hearing. So hearing is a foundation for these sensory pathways that Megan talked about, for the higher order language that develops and the cognitive skills that develop later on. They need that foundation of hearing. And by detecting hearing problems early on in the hospital, it's very important. And that happens for 97% of the newborns now. That's because there's legislation that has mandated it, and because the hospitals were actually cooperating before that to make it happen. So this cross-sector sort of cooperation can be good for young kids if there's support and you can have a way to implement it. And this is a way to prevent some of those problems before they begin. But the issue is, once they're screened with a hearing problem, the follow-up is not always there. So that you can find the kids with the hearing loss, but then 31% of them were enrolled in the follow-up program that would provide them the help that they needed. So you can see that fall-off also with well baby visits. That this is for the Medicaid population. It's pretty high for the first well baby visit for the 1-year-olds. But when you get to be older, you can see it drops down by 10% or more. American Indian kids, it drops down to from 90% down to 2/3 getting their second well baby visits. So we're less successful with getting the ongoing care and the ongoing support for their families. So we have to think about what is the reason for this. What are the systemic barriers that are keeping these families from getting the care? We often think of what's wrong with the families, but what's wrong with the system with regards to transportation issues, language issues, and cultural issues that impede that kind of care that these kids need? Head Start is a great investment when you talk about not working at one problem at a time, because it's comprehensive from the get-go. Head Start gets kids screened early. It helps with mental health, with dental health. It looks at the whole child. But we're falling behind in getting kids into Head Start. We were doing pretty good back about 10 years ago, where we had about 71% covered. But because of the growth in the low-income poverty population, we're only able to cover half of those eligible now. So even though there was a growth in slots, the growth in low-income kids is outstripping our resources to provide the Head Start services. That's for the three-year-olds. There's very little Head Start available for the younger kids. We don't have a lot of coverage for early Head Start, which would be even better if they had that early on. We don't just have that. There's been some additions with some of the stimulus money. I know that there's been added slots around the state, but that's still not covering all the kids that are eligible for early Head Start. These are some of the trends that are troubling. So infant mortality, we're the lowest overall in the nation, but you can see it started to go back up. And it's, if you're in the American Indian community, in the African American community, it's you know, above the national average. So it's not so good for those populations. Immunizations, on the wrong way, on the wrong path, eroding. See where the lines are going in the wrong direction. Same thing with hospital admissions for kids with asthma, age 3 and younger. It had improved, now it's going up and back up again. The gains have been eroded throughout the state. Child maltreatment. The about 1 in 5 kids in out-of-home placement right now are children aged 3 and younger. That was 12% 10 years ago. It's now 19%. They make up a larger proportion of those kids in out-of-home placement. These are the kids that are at high risk for the toxic stress that you're talking that Rob talked about earlier. It is disproportionate again for African American kids and American Indian kids. Although the largest number of kids in out-of-home placement that are 3 and younger, nearly 1,000 white children, are in out-of-home placement right now. So I wish we had an integrated data system so we could actually look at this information in an unduplicated way, as opposed to bar by bar by bar. But if you look at it bar by bar bar by bar, how many young children are vulnerable for the kinds of toxic stress we're talking about, for the kinds of brain development they might have a problem, for growing up in disadvantage in ways that really they wouldn't have to be. It's as many as 43,000 kids that are being raised in a home where they're not getting the kinds of serve and return that would help develop their brains. Almost 40,000 in that economically distressed home, which contributes to that depressed environment. Look at we have a lot of attention to how teen motherhood. But look at that, that's half of the kids that are being raised in homes that are affected by poverty, kids that are being raised in homes that are affected by poverty and maternal depression. We should put at least as much emphasis on that as we are on teen moms. So what can we do? If we are going to keep up with future population growth in this state, it's a demographic imperative. We have to start doing something differently. It means keeping up with the growing racial and ethnic diversity, which is what Minnesota is and is becoming. The groups that are the most vulnerable, that is the future population in Minnesota. Look at the growth, projected growth through 2020. And the largest growth is among Asian, Hispanic, American Indian, African Americans, and a decrease in the white population. So this is why when Rob says we must do something differently, this also is a reason we must do something differently. It's not just more of the same. Otherwise, we're going to get more disparities and more disadvantages, and they'll just keep growing because of the demographic changes in the state. So what's different? So this is the another way of looking at the Hydra. This is our state Hydra. But this is, how can we be more integrated? How can we not treat one problem at a time, but look at the whole child in the context of the family, where there's something going, help the mother and the father, not just the child, but help the whole family, help the mental health of the family, help the economic conditions of the family. So it may be a Herculean task, but we need that better coordination, that better connection, stronger connections across health and education and family support. And how can we increase the capacity of local community-based organizations that are used to working with the whole family to make sure that they can deliver the services in a way? In this environment, places are shutting down because of the economy. The ones that are the front line for the families, we need to figure out how we can protect those organizations as well to ensure that we're addressing these issues of language and culture and so on.
Well, you have a couple more minutes. Yeah, we're actually looking at cutting a lot of those right now.
Yeah, thank you.
And so there isn't a lot we can do.
Yeah. Right. All right. So what we're after is, how can we achieve more equitable results for all kids, even for those that, so they're not starting at a disadvantage? And right now, health, income, and education are, they're just totally connected. They're strongly connected. So if you are in poor health, you're more likely to have low income and low education. If you have low education, you're more likely to have poor health and low income. And if you're low education, you're more likely to have poor health and low income. You have to somehow break into this really awful triangle. So part of it is addressing the educational needs of the kids early on. But it also means doing things in a more holistic way by ensuring that we're addressing those healthcare needs of the younger population as well, so we can prevent those achievement gaps before they begin, even prevent them before age 3 because of the lack of prenatal care. So likely things will get worse if we don't do something different. Some children may not be ready to benefit from preschool even because of their brain development being harmed early on. So if we don't start looking at interventions earlier, they are already at a health and brain development disadvantage before they get to preschool. We really do need to address the whole child, the whole family, as early as we can. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Are there any quick questions? I see your contact information is on the back. And members, Dr. Chase has probably done a dozen studies on child care, on kids, or more than that. I know
more or less.
Almost any kind of research you might need, he can help you find it, and it's all local. You know, we're always looking for the Minnesota connection, and this is that. Representative Blythe?
Well, I appreciate your work, and also the kind of maybe undertone message that this is really a community problem, and we need to face it as a community problem and hit it at many areas. I this morning read a New York Times article about, this is another sort of depressing aspect of this, but the relationship of health and stress and heart disease even to a job loss was very disturbing to me. And to think that now, with all the data that you just laid before us, we're looking at more and more people losing their jobs and being more and more at risk and feeling the stress and how they pass that on to their children. And so it's a very disturbing time.
Right. Madam Chair, and I think we have to think about also, so many of those are in isolation. They're dealing with it on their own, and that's why either we strengthen the community resources, you bring resources to them through appropriate home visiting services, any way you can get to that family, because many of them are isolated as well, and that economic distress just compounds in that with that isolation.
Well, thank you. I want to thank Dr. Chase and Dr. Megan Gunner and Dr. Anda, for all of you for being here today. The members appreciate it, and we hope to have a continued dialogue with you about all of this. So thank you.
Thank you for your interest.
With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.